everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Sillman, and thank you for joining me today for What Women Must Know, a radio show dedicated to empowering women with truthful information so they can make the most informed decisions possible regarding their health, their hormones, optimal well-being. Everything requires being informed with truthful information. So it's a pleasure to have you join me today. We have another really fascinating and quite enlightening program planned for you. I know you'll really enjoy the content that we're going to be exploring. I want to remind everyone that if you haven't opted into my website, whatwomenmustknow.com, I really invite you to do so, because once you opt in there, you will be sent several of my special reports for free. I have many of my published articles, I have videos. It's a great educational site, so if you really want to learn more about what's going on with women's health and hormones, it's really the place to be. And also, you can visit me at the Facebook page, What Women Must Know. I guess you would say you can like me there, because I post on a regular basis all sorts of important information and latest research studies and articles, things that I find to be of immense importance and interest to all of us who are concerned and committed to getting our hormones back in balance and keeping ourselves healthy. So you are more than welcome to visit me at those places. Okay, well, many, many years ago, I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to meet somebody who I admired greately because of the wonderful work that she was doing. And it was a great opportunity to spend some time with my guest today, who is Dr. Geralyn Pryor. Dr. Pryor is a professor of endocrinology at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, Canada, and scientific director of the Center for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research, and is a clinician scientist whose work is internationally recognized. Her research and synthesis has shown the importance of progesterone as well as estrogen for women's bones, heart, and breast health, and also that perimenopause is hormonally distinct from menopause, entailing higher rather than low or dropping estrogen levels. Now, Dr. Pryor has done what I consider very groundbreaking and leading-edge research in support of the truth in regarding women's health, women's hormones, women's menstrual cycles. And as we share this journey that Geralyn has been on, that I've learned so much from, we'll see why she is such a champion for women's hormonal health and well-being. And it's such a pleasure having Dr. Geralyn Pryor on the show today. Hello, Dr. Geralyn Pryor.
Hi there. How are you, Cheryl?
I'm good. Well, here we are once again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is interesting how our journey has continued to intertwine our paths. And I'm so grateful, Geralyn, when I received the notice, the press report of the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of the center that you are now scientific director of and one of the founders, the Center for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research. So first of all, I want to congratulate you on that. I also want to congratulate you on your books, because you have authored two books. One of them is called Estrogen's Storm Season, Stories of Menopause, and I see you're a finalist in Health Section of Independent Publishers Book Awards in 2006. And you've recently co-authored The Estrogen Errors, Why Progesterone is Better for Women's Health. And that's, you know, groundbreaking work, Geralyn. Congratulations on all the wonderful work you're doing.
Thank you.
You know, you and I know the journey and the challenge it has been to try to get this story straight and what's going on with women's hormones. I don't really think most of our listeners really appreciate the historical perspective and why this is so important and why your work is so important as a internationally respected endocrinologist. So maybe we can start at the beginning, Geralyn. I'd like to start with what got you interested in this understanding of what's really going on with women's cyclic wisdom and what happens at perimenopause. And, you know, there in the press release, it was stated that your center for for menstrual cycle and ovulation research had three major scientific advances that you've helped with in correcting the understanding of what's going with ovulation, with perimenopause, and the benefits of progesterone. So I want us to explore all this. We have the time on the show today. And we'll just start with you, Geraldine. So,
okay.
I hope I haven't confused you too much.
No. I was a new academic in British Columbia. Before that, I'd been, besides my training, I'd been working in the far north in Alaska. And I realized, being a little strategic, that I needed an area of specialty within internal medicine and endocrinology in order to survive in an academic world. And that was in the 70s when the, if you can recall, the aerobic fad sort of took off. And everybody was talking about doing aerobics. Women were starting to run longer distances. Remember that by 1984, there was a women's marathon in the Olympics. So, but as women started doing longer runs, then immediately there were medical articles and many lay stories saying that exercise made women's periods go away, that it caused, you know, great problems for women's reproductive health. And I thought, wait a minute, what? How do you know that it's exercise? And if you do know that it's exercise, how do you prove it? So I just began asking those kind of questions because this blaming business sounded prejudicial to me, and I thought pretty rightly, I think, that women have been doing hard exercise since the beginning of time. So I began to ask questions, to develop tools that we could use for monitoring menstrual cycles and ovulation over time, and then did a study in which took me a while to get funding for, I have to say, like usual, in which we started off with about 80 women, all of whom were normal weight, non-smokers, who had regular cycles, who were ovulating regularly. And they had to show that in two different cycles. And then we tracked them all across 1 year. So they monitored every cycle for a whole year. Well, the trick was that about a third of those women were doing nothing special in terms of physical activity. About a third of them were regular runners, just running for health. And another third were serious runners who were training. And I think there were 19 women who ran a marathon during that year. And what we found was there was no difference in the menstrual cycle or in ovulation characteristics between women who were basically sedentary and women who were training for a marathon. Thus, I sort of blew out of the water the idea that exercise causes these changes.
Which is, those are important distinctions to be made, because if the myth persisted that women and exercise don't mix, it would really compromise what women were capable of doing. And
You know what? Even though the evidence is strong, there are two other prospective studies that show they can't show that exercise causes changes in the cycle. Over and over again, the association is implied to be causation. Mm-hmm. And what I think is that women who start exercising, one, their bodies have to adapt to it, you know, for a start, but also they're usually doing it because they're stressed out of their minds, because they're, you know, upset at themselves for being too fat or something. In other words, the stress and the weight change that go with some exercising are the causes of the abnormal cycles, not the exercise itself.
Right. So it's the stress process that's going on within them that can have an adverse effect on their cycles, but not the exercise. In fact, anything, exercise is probably beneficial.
That's right. So that's how I got started, and I learned very early that the most variable part of the women's reproductive cycle was the time of ovulation. And I began to get interested in the variations in the amount of progesterone that's produced only after you ovulate. And that same study, actually, I learned that you need progesterone as well as estrogen in order to prevent bone loss in healthy young women.
Was this a revelation at the time, Geralyn?
Oh, totally.
Right.
Progesterone wasn't on the radar at all.
Right.
And estrogen does everything for bones.
Right.
Unfortunately, there's still a bunch of people who think that.
Right. I think it's really important to put that in the historical context and why your work is so important, because there were these myths that had never been challenged regarding women's health and women's hormones, such as that estrogen was the key hormone and it was responsible for bones and everything else. And
bones and heart and your brain and you name it.
Right. And it just gave credibility for the whole hormone replacement therapy.
Right.
You know,
I don't even like to say that term. Replacement is just wrong.
Yeah. I know. So I want to talk about these three areas that your center, the Center for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research, really investigated and revealed,
kind of
set the record straight, because there are three key things going on here. So let's start with an ovulation. And, you know, it's interesting. I've been seeing a lot of patients lately, and some are in their 30s. Some, they're generally in their 30s. Some are early 40s who have been diagnosed with premenopause. And I went, well, why don't we talk about you as being anovulatory, maybe amenorrhea, rather than this label of being premenopausal, which is like, it's like it's a finality if you consider yourself premenopause or early menopause.
Perimenopause.
No, they were diagnosed as early menopause.
Oh,
menopause. Because they didn't
early
have,
menopause.
They were missing menstrual cycles. But they were 38, 39, 40.
Mm-hmm.
So young to be perimenopausal, at least to be menopause.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
but no one talks about amenorrhea or anovulation anymore.
Well, there's a fundamental confusion, which it took me, I'm ashamed to say, quite a while to figure out. And that is that gynecologists typically say anovulation when they mean not having a period at all.
Mm-hmm.
And they and that's an important distinction, because what I was just talking about that happened in all of the women in that longitudinal study I mentioned is that they had perfectly regular periods, but some cycles they didn't make an egg at all, and therefore they didn't make progesterone. And other cycles they made an egg all right, and they made progesterone, but for a very short time. Not enough, really, for them, for their health.
Right.
And those silent disturbances of ovulation hiding within regular cycles were basically unrecognized. And there are still some people who don't recognize that a regular cycle without ovulation is different than a regular cycle with ovulation.
And I think we need to just define that a bit more for women listening, because I don't think people understand that you could have a bleed every month, which is what you're
That's
saying
right.
about having a cycle, but not always be ovulating and
That's
not
right.
always be being able to produce enough progesterone. May be ovulating, but not necessarily producing adequate progesterone. Is that correct?
That's right.
And you would never know it because you're still bleeding. Well, I was going to say we'd never know it because it looks like we're having a menstrual cycle.
That's right. And in fact, we just did a study because I'm keen on developing things that women can observe for themselves. So one of the things that I thought would be helpful is if you ask the question, can you tell by the way you feel that your period is coming? That if women were ovulating, there would be some very characteristic changes. And we did a study in 610 women, not on the pill or anything else, who had periods that were reasonably regular, and we discovered they couldn't tell. Even when they were trained and they were keeping a diary record, they still couldn't tell. So it's a problem. We need a tool that will tell us for each cycle, did I ovulate or not?
So tell the audience, people who are listening, why that is such an important concern, why not ovulating every month is something that that has consequences.
Okay. Well, the simplest way of understanding that is that either anovulation, meaning you didn't make an egg at all, or ovulation with a short luteal phase cause infertility. Okay? So that's the obvious reason. But that early study that I mentioned showed that you needed normal amounts of progesterone or you lost bone. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's sort of like we have bone in a bank and we gain the maximum amount of our bank account when we're in our mid-20s, say. And then if we, you know, if there's a silent withdrawal from that account until we reach perimenopause, we may end up with osteoporosis soon.
Mm-hmm.
So losing bone is really important.
Because of that connection between progesterone helps to build the osteoblast.
That's right.
The new bone.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you can have enough estrogen, but not enough progesterone and still lose bone.
Right.
And in fact, we're in the final stages of analyzing and submitting a paper that is now including 5 different groups of women. The first one that I just told you about, and 4 more, that all show the same thing, that you need to regularly make an egg and make enough progesterone in order to prevent bone loss when you're young, healthy, and doing everything right.
You know, 2 things come to mind. First of all, I was going to ask you, why would a woman ovulate but not make enough progesterone?
Okay, there's a good question. I think the strongest reason, the most prevalent reason, is emotional stress of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
It happens also if you're losing weight. It happens early on as you're adapting to more strenuous exercise. But the commonest reason in our society is that we're emotionally upset about something, or we're in a social or political bind of some sort.
Mm-hmm. So that emotional stress gets translated into the body being out of balance.
Yeah.
It's impacting.
Yeah.
Which
yeah, the brain is pretty smart, and
yeah.
It says, look here, lady, you don't want to get pregnant when you're this upset.
Right. And the other key piece of your research shows that if women do have these lack of ovulations or lack of making adequate progesterone, then they're at risk of bone loss, which means that bone loss can be occurring far earlier than was originally thought.
That's right. And so far we don't know whether that loss is related to breaking bones when you're menopausal, but logic suggests it would be, because the average loss for the people with the worst ovulation compared to the people in these groups of women with the best ovulation is about 1% loss. And if you add that up over the 35 or 40 years of premenopause, you could end up with really a major amount of loss.
Mm. Can you talk a bit about what happens when women go on the pill? And of course, the pill is not just prescribed now for contraceptive purposes. It's prescribed for heavy periods, painful periods, not having any periods, making sure you don't bleed, you know, acne, you know, for so many things.
Okay. Well, the hormonal combined oral contraceptive, official term, consists of a high dose estrogen that's about four times higher than our natural dose, even in the what we call, and I'll put them in quotes, low dose birth control pills, and a progestin, a synthetic relative of progesterone. And usually they're taken for 21 or 24 days out of 28, which then those hormone levels talk back to the brain and they say, don't bother to stimulate the ovary to do anything this month. You know, we don't need you. And so in doing that, it suppresses our own hormones.
And I mean that has such consequences when we are shutting off, taking offline our own natural hormonal production and cycles.
Yes, I think so. It's especially I won't quarrel with someone who says I've tried or I've looked at all of the other options for contraception. I'm sexually active. I need something effective, and the pill is my only option. But I think everyone listening should understand that the evidence for the other so-called non-contraceptive benefits, and there must be, I don't know, hundreds of articles out there in the medical literature that describe these, the evidence for most of them is just prejudicial. It's pro-pill.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there's a recent statement that says that the pill is helpful for bone. And the evidence for that is basically non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what we know now is especially younger women, say less than 20, and especially those who are on a 30 microgram dose or higher, are going to be not gaining their peak bone mass. Not putting money into that bone bank. They're going to start off with a lower account than those women who don't take the pill.
Now, is that because the pill causes all this deficiency of key nutrients in the body that they're...
Don't have a clue, really.
Hmm.
It's taken... Well, years ago, I did a study with a large population-based sample of women and discovered that the Canadian Multicenter Osteoporosis Study and discovered that women who'd never used the pill, and out of the 500, there were about 80 who'd never used the pill, had higher bone density than those who'd ever used it.
Hmm.
And it took me about 3 years to get that published, but I finally did. And now, finally, there are some studies that look at that change in bone once somebody's on a pill versus women who of the same age who aren't on a pill. But the evidence that the pill is good for bones is really not true.
Right. You know, I've seen recently studies coming out talking about increased incidence of breast cancer for women who've been on the pill. Do you have some thoughts about that?
The incidence is there. It's increased, but it's not very high.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something like a 30% increase risk for breast cancer if you've used the pill. And anyone who tells you that will say, but it decreases your risk of ovarian cancer by threefold or some such thing. I don't really know. I don't remember the numbers. But that's kind of, well, it doesn't add up because breast cancer is very, very common, whereas ovarian cancer is very, very rare. Right?
Right.
So, and there's lots of other ways to prevent ovarian cancer, like ovulating regularly.
Right, right, right. So what you're saying is that there have been these beliefs that have been perpetuated, but there has been no evidence And somehow it just, someone came up with the theory, and then it was just accepted. And your work, and you know, you've mentioned a couple of times the challenge it was to get things published, to get funding, because as a more feminine-centered practitioner, you're running up against a system that doesn't really appreciate the value of what you've dedicated to.
Yeah, and in fact, there are fundamental challenges to the center that I'm running persisting into the future that have to do with precisely what you're talking about. It's interesting. It's really interesting, and I always fall back on the sort of belief that whenever you get resistance, it means you're doing something important. So I guess we're doing something important.
I guess you are, but you really see the bias of a system, I like to call the patriarchal system, that still persists and doesn't allow the acknowledgement of what's really going on with women, but perpetuating myths that somehow support the system. And you know, one of the best examples of what I want you to talk about is the truth about perimenopause, because this is where I think we first met many moons ago when I was
Was in Australia, wasn't it?
I was still living in Australia, and we'll get into that story in a minute. But before we leave that and before we take our break, what do you recommend to those women who are dealing with who don't have menstrual cycles, who have an ovulatory cycles, either irregular ovulations or haven't been ovulating for a while?
Okay, so you said three different things. They don't have their period, or they do have their period, but they're not ovulating. Okay, so at present, the standard treatment is the birth control pill. And I would urge women to avoid that if they can. The first thing to do is to see a good physician to find out why your body, especially if you don't have a period for 6 months. You need to find out why, and there are some serious reasons why you might skip a period that long. And one of them could be a pituitary tumor, right? Mm-hmm. So see a good physician who will take you seriously, who will investigate and make sure there's no disease that's causing it. The second thing to do is to make sure that you're eating well, your weight is healthy, you're neither too skinny nor too overweight, because that can be part of the problem. Thirdly, make sure you get at least 2,000 units of vitamin D a day. Mm-hmm. And if you can, if you like dairy foods, have 3 or 4 of them a day. So you're getting enough calcium, or you can supplement with calcium. And fourthly, take a serious look at the stressors in your life and see whether or not there's something that you're kind of ducking and not dealing with that's affecting you at a subconscious level enough to disrupt your cycle.
And, you know, the impact of stress can never be underestimated.
No, it's pervasive.
Yeah.
And it's so important. Yeah. It's really, really important. Then, just to finish this up, if everything checks out, you don't have a disease, it's not underweight or overweight, you're working on your stresses, I would ask that you have a bone density. Ask your doctor to order a bone density, because that is a serious issue that can happen when you've lost your period. Not having estrogen causes you to lose bone rapidly. Not having estrogen and progesterone causes you to lose bone, but not as rapidly. But I did a study some years ago in women who were otherwise healthy, normal weight, non-smoking, exercising regularly, and randomized them to extra calcium or to cyclic progestin. We didn't have the natural hormone then, so it was medroxyprogesterone. Gave it to them for 10 days every month. And those who were on the active medicine gained bone. So that's another option, only now I would recommend the natural progesterone for 14 days every month.
Geralyn, we need to take a break, and when we come back, we have some really important information that we need to be sharing with all the people listening in. So don't go away, in anyone out there listening. Stay tuned, because this is really very leading-edge information that we're going to be sharing with you today. And my guest today is Dr. Geralyn Pryor. She is the director of the Center for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research, the scientific director. And this is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know, and we will be right back. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know. And today we are talking to Dr. Geralyn Pryor from Vancouver, British Columbia. She is the scientific director for the Center for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research, really a groundbreaking organization that's been focusing on really understanding the menstrual cycle and what is happening with women's reproductive hormones. She's also the author of Estrogen Storm Season, and her recent book, and I'm looking here for it, Geralyn. What is
your book? The Estrogen Errors.
Estrogen Errors. I have all these notes in front of me.
Why progesterone is better for women's health.
Yay.
It's now out as an e-book, actually.
Oh, really?
Though it's still horrifyingly expensive. It's not my fault. I'm sorry. But certainly I'm not getting rich off of it. And all of my royalties go to the center anyway. So,
right.
But it is out as an e-book as well as in print now.
Okay, so tell our listeners how they can get that e-book.
Okay, I know it's available through Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's my best understanding. I don't know all the accessibility in the U.S., but it's certainly that way. And now, thankfully, Estrogen Storm Season is also available online. If you go to the SEMCOR website, www.cemcor.ubc.ca, you can find the information there and follow the links and also order that one online.
Great. That's fantastic. I hope people really follow up, because it's fantastic information. It's just so mind-blowing. I have a question before we get into perimenopause. So we've been talking about women who are missing ovulations or perhaps not making enough progesterone, even if they do happen to ovulate. And then if they notice that they are having some problems with their cycles, they go to the doctor. And why is it that 9 times out of 10, Geralyn, their medical doctor, their primary care, their gynecologist, whoever it is, will put them on the pill for irregular menstrual cycle? What is the thinking that that's going to somehow bring things back online?
I don't know. It's crazy thinking, actually. It's basically covering up the problem rather than dealing with it. And just those of you who want to better understand this, there was a large study where women said, okay, I've been on the pill, I want to stop it, or I've been on a barrier method, I want to stop it. All tracked their, we're working on fertility, okay? And it took the women with barrier method contraception about 3 months on average to get pregnant. It took the women who'd been on the pill about 9 months.
Yeah.
So our cycles get really squished and suppressed. It's almost like our body doesn't really know how to do it anymore.
Right.
When you're on that high dose suppression.
And I mean, are you seeing more of an incidence of infertility occurring in women?
Well, I don't do infertility very much, but the colleagues of mine who do are talking about younger and younger women who are presenting with infertility.
Yeah.
And that's a worry.
Absolutely. Do they have any, in their model of the world, any understanding or any theories of why that's happening, or why do you think that's happening?
Well, I don't really know, but I think the combination of our too fast lifestyle and use of the pill at an early age may contribute.
Yeah, I was horrified when I discovered that they're putting, in some cases, 12 and 13-year-olds on the pill. Maybe even
I know.
They have, they're, you know, menstruating at a younger and younger age now.
Before we are weeping tears of great sadness, however, let me just give you a couple of good news things.
Okay.
One is that the CDC, the Center for Communicable Diseases and Prevention in the U.S., just came out with news that more younger women are abstaining from needing contraception until they get to be older. And when they do need contraception, they're using more effective methods. And so the teenage pregnancy rate has gone down in the U.S.
What would be more, what would be more effective methods?
Well, they define it as anything from the pill, the vaginal ring or the patch, an IUD, and these implants, which I wouldn't recommend anyone use.
Right. Right. Those implants.
Hmm?
Oh, I shudder at the thought of implants.
I know.
Because I've seen the consequences. So, for all the mothers, grandmothers, young women listening, it's just so important to understand how critical it is to have a menstrual cycle and how we need to support it through managing stress and good nourishment, and just honoring our bodies. Let's talk about perimenopause.
Sure.
And I want to put that in historical context, and it kind of goes back to where we first connected, because when I was researching women's hormonal imbalances, there was a time when this is when HRT, hormone replacement therapy, was very, very popular, and there was a trend to show that perimenopausal women, these women have 5 to 10 years before their menstrual cycles ceased, actually were showing low progesterone levels and therefore would so much be benefited by putting them on HRT. I'm going to let you take it from there.
Okay, I'm going to back it up even further.
Okay.
I'm just before the baby boom generation, and I'm trained in hormones and endocrinology, and my special area is women's reproduction, and I'm in my late 40s. My periods are perfectly regular, and I start having weird things happen. First of all, I get heavy flow. My breasts are really, really sore. I start waking in the middle of the night sweating, and I'm trying to figure out what the heck is going on. Because night sweats, I was taught, meant low estrogen, but heavy flow and sore breasts mean high estrogen. This doesn't compute, right? So, and I'm very miserable, and I'm quite clear myself that the misery is connected to higher than normal estrogen levels. So I start trying to figure this out. And I'm looking, and I'm looking, and I'm looking, and I can't find any information that would tell me that estrogen levels go higher in perimenopause. But eventually, I began, it was basically a whole year search. I would spend nights and weekends looking at all the references in papers, going to the library. Eventually, I put all of the evidence together where within one center they looked at the hormone levels of women who were still premenopausal and women who were perimenopausal, and sure enough, estrogen was significantly higher. And I was lucky enough to get that published in 1998, but the concept that this transition from reproductive, normal, young, etc., into menopause was associated with rising levels of estrogen, was one that was just not on the radar when I began researching it. And our research proved that it was higher and proved that progesterone was lower. And most recently, I have two things that are pretty neat. One is done a review paper that shows the ways in which progesterone is helpful for perimenopausal women. The idea is that estrogen's too high. It's high because the whole system is sort of a planned disruption. Basically, the body's trying to get rid of all of those eggs so that we don't have periods when we're 80, right? So we want to get rid of them quick. Each one makes some estrogen. Estrogen's higher. So that's the plan, and you can't disrupt it, as far as I know. But progesterone's job in the body is to either counterbalance or complement the actions of estrogen. So if you take progesterone, then it'll make things like the heavy flow and the sore breasts better. And sure enough, I ended up needing it for the hot flushes. And the other part of the good news story is that we now are doing a randomized controlled trial of progesterone for hot flushes in perimenopausal women. Mm. And that's never been done before.
Because the why this is so significant is that there was this misconception that our ovaries were shutting down at perimenopause,
right,
and all the symptoms of the hot flashes, the night sweats, the mood swings, everything was related to this rapidly declining estrogen levels. And so the savior for women was putting them on more estrogen.
Yeah, the birth control pill or hormone replacement type therapy. And, you know, we got this randomized control trial funded of the perimenopause progesterone hot flush one by showing that there isn't any good evidence that the birth control pill helps hot flushes, or even in perimenopausal women, that taking hormone-like therapy helps hot flushes.
And not only that, I mean, now you're taking these high doses of hormones in your body, especially taking high doses of estrogen, because you're already estrogen dominant.
Yep.
And this could be driving conditions that can manifest, you know, that can lead to things like breast cancer, you know.
Blood clots and heart problems.
Yeah. So women were being set up to take a drug back at this in the 1990s, I guess, were being set up to be put on hormones that would increase their incidence of chronic life-threatening illnesses. That's where we were going. And it was your research that really demonstrated this was an error.
Yep. And unfortunately, you'll still get... I mean, that's one of the things I've learned over the last 30 years or so of doing research and working with women, is that women need to understand and ask questions and challenge the existing explanations if they don't make sense. And it's only by changing what women know that we can change how they're treated.
Absolutely, you know, absolutely, and that's why it's so important, the work you're doing, and, you know, the work that I committed to do is trying to get truthful information out there, because how can you make the best decision on flawed information?
So one of the fundamental aspects of the work I've been doing about perimenopause is helping us to have a separate word for that phase of life compared to what I call menopause, starting a year after your last period, or some people call postmenopause. Mm-hmm. But the word perimenopause is the right way to describe it. But don't say menopause, because then your doctor or your friend or somebody else immediately gets this vision of some elderly, decrepit, wizened up old thing, which is not the situation.
You're here.
Yeah.
Not at all. Not at all. And we do need to use the right terms, and we do need to have the correct understanding of what is occurring in our bodies. So we support the process, and this is where your work with progesterone is so important, because it was progesterone that became very deficient that led to this estrogen excess relationship.
Well, it's a combination, actually. Progesterone is absolutely low, lower than in a... The reference is obviously the premenopausal cycle. Mm-hmm. So progesterone is absolutely low and estrogen is absolutely high, then the ratio of them is totally off.
Mhm. Mhm.
So if you are having troubles in perimenopause, go to the SEMCOR website. Be sure to, I can give it to you again, www.cemcor.ubc.ca, and look it up, and you'll find things there you can download and print out for your family doctor, and you'll find things there that are helpful, you know, for you.
And I think we should just elaborate a little bit more, Geralyn. When you do have this imbalance of high estrogen in relationship to low progesterone, mm-hmm. what are the concerns? What are the symptoms? What are the risk factors that women will be experiencing?
Well, heavy bleeding, sore breasts, weight gain, migraine headaches, increased cramps, just as a start. It's not clear that the sleep problems are hormonally based, or for sure what's going on with the night sweats, which interestingly tend to cluster around the period. In fact, I observed that I would get a night sweat the night before my flow started, even when my period was perfectly regular.
Mm-hmm.
And that's now been shown by several groups.
But what you're saying is there's not a clear understanding of why that is.
No, it's not directly related to, at least so far, to what we know about estrogen or progesterone.
Mm-hmm.
I think of all the hot flushes and night sweats as a withdrawal from the brain. It's like the brain has gotten addicted to estrogen, and so it's like a opioid withdrawal. It's like being on narcotics and addicted to them and then suddenly not having them anymore. It's the same phenomenon in the brain that causes hot flushes and, or flashes, I guess, as you say, and night sweats.
Yeah. So you've been really promoting the use of progesterone, bioidentical, the same molecular mm-hmm. hormone that our body makes, not the synthetic form any longer. Well, do you see that this is more commonly accepted in the medical profession now? I think it was a grassroots movement for a long time. Women were looking at this, but the medical practitioners are a little more resistant.
Well, it is and it isn't. You know, there's a certain segment of the expert community that is very resistant to change. So, for example, we knew the results of our menopause hot flush study by June of 2010, and it took us until January of 2012 to get the data published. I think we had 7 rejections.
Hmm.
I mean, so that's a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial.
Right.
Registered.
Do they give reasons? Do they give reasons why they reject?
Oh yeah, different ones each time.
Right. Right. But you finally got it published.
You know, I've learned to read between the lines and rejections, and the bottom line is I don't believe it.
Right. Right.
And when you get silly, you know, complaints about this, or you didn't do that, or you described this in the wrong way, and all of it doesn't add up to a rejection, but it's rejected, then you can tell that the person just simply isn't a scientist, doesn't believe real data. Right.
Well, thank goodness you're so persistent, Gerald, and you don't give
up. Yeah, my record is over 25 rejections and 12 years.
Wow. Well,
and I finally got the paper published.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. You know, I mean, I'm so pleased. I know, you know, this really is landmark work that's bringing in this awareness of how our bodies really work. It's helping to dispel so many of the myths and misinformation and distortions and inaccuracies of what's going on with our female body and our...
It's using the science to help women is what we're trying to do. And we're trying to understand it in ways that make sense for women. And that's why the website is so important, because it's a way of getting the information out. What good is it if you know something if the people who care about it don't know it?
Right. You know, we just have a couple of minutes left, Geraldine. Is there anything that you want to share that we haven't gotten around to discussing?
Yes, two things. One is that that progesterone is a very good option for women who are postmenopausal and have bad hot flushes, and it also helps sleep. So if sleep is part of the problem, then you should tell your doctor that that's something you would like to try. So that's the paper that's just out in Menopause, just out in the last month. And the other thing that's important, and this is something that you should learn and then pass on to every woman who could potentially menstruate that you know, and that is that heavy menstrual bleeding is helped a lot by over-the-counter ibuprofen, Advil or whatever the brand name is.
Mm-hmm.
So the standard pill size is just 200 milligrams.
Uh-huh.
On any day, flow day that's heavy, take one every 6 hours while you're awake.
Mm-hmm.
And that will decrease the flow by between 25 by a quarter or a half, which is often enough to allow us to function.
Why is that? I mean, we only have a minute.
Okay.
Or so,
well,
but...
the uterus has two different prostaglandins, and heavy flow is associated with an imbalance that ibuprofen writes.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's the greatest information, and in fact, by publicizing that, the hysterectomy rate in British Columbia has decreased to a third of what it used to be.
Well, because heavy bleeding is one of the major
reasons. It's the major reason for getting a hysterectomy.
Yeah, because when we can't become anemic. Would any other form of anti-inflammatory help, you think?
Yes, yeah. But the reason I say ibuprofen is because it's over-the-counter.
Right.
In other words, you don't need a prescription for one of the other ones. Ibuprofen works.
Well, Geraldine, this has been such a wonderful conversation, as always. I really thank you. I thank you so much for your persistence, your commitment to really righting the wrongs about what's going on with our female physiology. And it's always such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Cheryl. And let me make one last plug. If there's anybody who has a lot of resources and who wants to donate to SEMCOR to keep it going, please do, and we can make sure you get a U.S. tax receipt.
Wonderful. I hope you have some very good benefactors listening. Dr. Geraldine Pryor, thank you so much, and continue the great work you're doing.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. We've been talking with Dr. Geraldine Pryor. She's the scientific director for the Center for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research. She's an endocrinologist practicing in Vancouver, B.C. You've been listening to What Women Must Know. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and thank you for tuning in. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.